Europe gets the vaccine, but inoculating 450 million people will take time.
We do not have enough vaccination available right now, and it's likely we'll stay this way for the next weeks, if not months.
I'm Carol Hills. Also, a gigantic Antarctic iceberg is drifting toward a sanctuary for wildlife. Scientists are worried about what it might do to the animals there.
It's quite a beautiful island, but the number of seals and penguins vastly outnumber the humans.
And at a camp for refugees from the Ethiopian region of Tigray, a mechanic makes fried bread to get by, and a doctor worries about psychological trauma. We take you there ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. The global race to vaccinate is on, and on Sunday, it reached Europe. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen tweeted, "Today, we start turning the page on a difficult year." The coordinated effort to inoculate 450 million EU citizens from the virus that causes COVID-19 is just about 24 hours old now, but the massive effort has already seen a couple of hiccups. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us from London. Orla, how's the vaccination effort going so far?
Well, there has been a couple of hiccups, as you mentioned, but so far in most parts of the EU, things have gone relatively smoothly. It's up to each EU country to decide who will receive the vaccine first. But what we've seen over the last 24 hours or so is that many countries are doing exactly what the UK did a couple of weeks ago, and that they're starting by vaccinating the elderly and frontline healthcare workers, etc. So in Austria, the first woman to be vaccinated was an 84-year-old great-grandmother who, after she was vaccinated, said she just wanted to meet her children and her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren and not to have to worry when she was hugging them. In Italy, on the other hand, it was a 29-year-old nurse who was the first to get the jab. Ursula von der Leyen, as you said, the EU Commission president, described all of this as a European success story. And, Carol, she described it as a touching moment of unity. But actually, I should say, Hungary, Slovakia and even Germany broke with this sense of unity yesterday, because they started their vaccinations on Saturday, a day earlier than the rest of Europe. What was interesting to see in the Czech Republic and in Greece was that some of the first people to get the vaccines there were actually the country's prime ministers. And this was a question I put to German epidemiologist Tobias Kurth earlier, asking him whether he thought it was a good thing that political leaders were seen to get the vaccine first.
I think it's probably an important sign to the public that the political leaders are not afraid of the vaccine. And I think the medical staff certainly deserves to be vaccinated among the first, and then nursing home inhabitants and so on. It's likely just a very important message to the public if the politicians publicly get vaccinated and say, look, I'm doing this.
I know there were also some reports over the last 24 hours of a few problems in delivering the vaccine to some EU countries. Tell us about those.
Yeah, first of all, in Germany, in the state of Bavaria, it was discovered that some of the vaccine shots may not have been kept as cold as they ought to have done during transit. So the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, as you know, has to be kept at these freezing temperatures of around minus 94 Fahrenheit. But with this one batch in particular, it was found that the temperature in the cool box had risen to the equivalent of 59 degrees Fahrenheit, which was far higher than it ought to ever have been. And at the moment, they're waiting to see if they'll just have to discard those shots altogether. The Spanish authorities today are also reporting that deliveries to 8 EU countries have been delayed because of issues with temperature controls. And then this evening in Germany, it's being reported that 8 workers in a care home received what they describe as an overdose. In fact, it was a far higher dose of the vaccine than they were supposed to, but they've ended up in hospital with flu-like symptoms. So there are some incidents like this happening. But I was talking to Tobias Kurth about this, the German epidemiologist, and, you know, asking him about the sort of the various hiccups, etc. And he said, you know, look, we expect to have some issues in the beginning that need ironing out. But actually, he's more concerned about another issue.
We do not have enough vaccination available right now, and it's likely we'll stay this way for the next weeks, if not months, although we are ready, we're just waiting for more vaccinations to come that we can vaccinate more people.
And the good news on that front, Carl, is that it does look like the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine may be receiving approval here at the very least sometime soon.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks as always, Orla.
You're welcome, Carl.
South Africa yesterday recorded its 1 millionth case of COVID-19. Several hospitals and medical centers there have reached capacity. And as a new variant of the virus circulates, the South African government is expected to announce increased restrictions to slow its spread. Dr. Richard Lessels is an infectious disease expert in Durban. Dr. Lessels, the recent surge is being attributed to a relatively new, more infectious variant of the virus that's circulating in South Africa now. What's new or especially troubling about this variant?
It's clear that this variant is now the predominant virus variant that's spreading. But a lot of the spread is still, of course, because of human behavior and because we're giving the virus enough opportunity to spread. So it's not solely down to this new variant of the virus.
And just to be clear, is this South African variant the same one that we're hearing about in the UK or a different one?
It's not. So we can show through genetic analysis that these two variants have arisen independently. So they've evolved independently in South Africa and in the UK.
What is the South African government doing to address this second surge, to address these disturbing statistics and level of spread at this point?
Recently, the emphasis has really been put on trying to influence individuals' behavior and trying to educate people as to the severity of the situation. But there's been a reluctance to introduce harder restrictions, I think, because we saw some of the damage of that with the earlier kind of harder lockdown periods and not being able to support people economically and socially through that period.
What kind of new restrictions are you expecting?
President Cyril Ramaphosa is speaking to the nation again this evening. It's what we call a family meeting when he speaks to us. And it's difficult to know how strict the measures are likely to be now. Really, what I'm looking for is more restrictions around public gatherings and places where people are still mixing in large numbers indoors.
Vaccinations have not yet begun in South Africa. When are you expecting them to start?
Rollout of vaccines has not begun. That's correct. We are taking part in some of the clinical trials. So there have been people vaccinated as part of the clinical trials in South Africa. We're expecting to get some vaccines in the first two quarters of 2021. But our understanding at the moment is that the first tranche will only be enough for about 3% of the population, and then subsequently up to kind of 10% of the population. And obviously that is primarily targeted at preventing deaths in those at highest risk. But it's not necessarily then preventing the transmission of the virus between the younger age groups and into the middle-aged groups.
As an infectious disease expert, are there things you sit there and think, we've got to do this, this has got to happen fast, we need X, Y, and Z? I mean, what are those things that you think really have to happen soon for South Africa?
I think for me, we're quite late now with what's happening. So any intervention or any measures introduced now are quite late for the second wave. But we certainly need to introduce stricter measures immediately to help the health services. But I think for me, what we learned from coming out of the first wave and now the second wave is that you really need to do a lot more when you come out of these peaks. I think, like many countries, and this is not unique to South Africa, we were a little bit complacent when we came up out of that first peak. And we took our eye off the ball in terms of trying to suppress transmission to very low levels. And really what happened with this second surge starting in Eastern Cape was we had never really controlled the transmission in Eastern Cape coming out of that first wave. And that's also what we think has then contributed to the emergence of this new variant, this new lineage, because we never really stopped and controlled the transmission in that part of the country.
Dr. Richard Lessels is an infectious disease expert in South Africa. He's been speaking to us from Durban. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
In Saudi Arabia today, an anti-terrorism court sentenced women's rights activist Loujain Al-Hathloul to nearly 6 years in prison. Al-Hathloul was jailed in 2018 after starting a campaign to advocate for women to be allowed to drive in the kingdom. With us now to discuss the implications of the case is Hiba Zayadeen. She's a researcher on Gulf affairs with Human Rights Watch. Hiba, first off, a point of clarity. Al-Hathloul was sentenced to 6 years, but the court then actually suspended part of that sentence. How much longer will she actually be in prison?
So according to our calculations, she should be released in a couple of months because she has been in prison for 2.5 years already and because of the suspended sentence. But that does not mean that she is going to be granted her freedom. She is still under a travel ban for the same period as her jail term, so 5 years and 8 months. And of course, the sentence hangs over her head and she could be thrown back in jail for any perceived criminal activity.
Now, there's a paradox here because Al-Hathloul, she was known for her campaign to allow Saudi women to drive. And a few months after she was detained, Saudi women were finally allowed to drive. I mean, in what other ways have women's rights in Saudi Arabia changed since she's been locked up?
So basically, you know, besides her campaigning for the right to drive, she had been a huge proponent of the end of the discriminatory male guardianship system, which ties women to their male guardians, whether that be their father or their husbands or even their sons at the time, and who make critical decisions on their behalf. That is one area that the Saudi government has also sought to reform. And so that's where you see the hypocrisy. And really, it just goes to show that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman wants to be the only reformer in the kingdom. There is no place for others to really partner in this vision, in this what he calls modernization.
What is the significance of this sentencing coming when it does, 2.5 years after she was first jailed?
So, I mean, at this point, the conviction at this time especially is definitely a strategy by the Saudi authorities to try and, you know, minimize the global attention to the case. You know, she's been convicted during the holidays when they're banking on the world not paying attention to this. It is unclear why they had rushed her trial so quickly at the terrorism court after it had been suspended for 1.5 years, after she had been jailed for 2.5 years and had been subjected to torture, sexual assault, harassment. And so this rushing of her trial at the terrorism court, which is notorious and quite abusive, and where unfair trials have been rampant, really just goes to show that, you know, the Saudi government views women's rights activism as a form of terrorism.
Hiba, were you surprised by this sentence, or is it basically what you expected?
We were definitely surprised because in the previous weeks, as they were rushing the case in the terrorism court, you know, the international community had really come together and had really shown solidarity in Loujain's case. We know that the Saudi government is seeking to be seen as a modernizing force, as a progressive country on the international stage. We know that they are sensitive to their global image, and we really did hope that this kind of international pressure from UN experts, from diplomats around the world and human rights organizations would lead to her immediate release. And so this is definitely quite disappointing. This is no victory in any way. And really, it is a message to any other activist within the country and even abroad of the consequences that they could face if they don't toe the line.
Hiba Zayadeen is a researcher on Gulf affairs with Human Rights Watch. Thanks, Hiba.
Anytime. Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Scientists have been watching the world's largest free-floating iceberg with bated breath. It broke off Antarctica 2 years ago and has been a floating liability ever since. The threat has been steadily increasing, though, as A68, as it's known, inches closer toward a wildlife sanctuary on South Georgia Island that penguins, seals, and blue whales call home. Now there's a glimmer of hope. The iceberg has been breaking apart. British Antarctic Survey scientist Paul Abrahamson is leading an expedition to visit the iceberg. Paul, I understand this iceberg was originally the size of Delaware, but now it's breaking apart. How big is it now, and is it good that it's broken up?
Yes, I mean, it certainly has lost quite a lot of ice, and that's both because of melting and also because parts are breaking off the edges of the iceberg. So since it was calved from the Larsen Sea ice shelf 2.5 years ago, it's lost about half of its area and probably closer to 2/3 of the volume.
There's an urgency now because the iceberg, and it's broken up, but it's still quite large and is floating towards South Georgia Island. What is the concern at this point?
We are concerned that even though it's now moved slightly to the south of South Georgia, the currents will take it back around to the north side of the island, and there is still a risk it may run aground there.
And South Georgia, of course, is in the South Atlantic, east of Lower South America, if I can place it there. Tell us a bit about South Georgia Island. Does anybody live there? I mean, what is it like there?
It's quite a beautiful island, but the number of seals and penguins vastly outnumber the humans. It may have up to half of the world's king penguins. So there are glaciers and ice, but during summer, it's actually a very green, very lush environment.
Now, what would happen if this iceberg floats into the coast of South Georgia Island? What's the concern for scientists?
The concerns are mainly how it might impact the animals that live on the island, if it could interfere with their foraging. And that could be directly because the iceberg could block their paths. They might have to travel further away from their colonies to forage. And also indirectly, if the iceberg runs aground there, it would be melting and releasing a lot of fresh water into the ocean. Changes to the salinity and the temperature could really impact the very bottom of the food chain, the plankton. And of course, that in turn will impact everything above it, the krill and then the seals and penguins and whales that eat them.
You're planning an expedition to visit the iceberg. What are you hoping to find out?
We're planning to go to South Georgia and the Southern Ocean as part of our routine monitoring of the ecosystem and the climate. So we're hoping to release two little ocean robots called gliders, which will be out for almost 4 months and study the effects of the iceberg on the seas around South Georgia.
Do you consider this whole study a sort of a climate change story, really?
Well, it's not directly climate change related. You know, it's quite a natural process that icebergs calve off the glaciers around Antarctica. We can't say that, you know, this particular iceberg is a direct result of climate change. But we do think that in the future, as the climate warms, then this might become a more common occurrence. There might be more icebergs calving off the ice shelves.
Paul Abrahamson is an oceanographer at the British Antarctic Survey. He's been speaking to us from Cambridge, England. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you.
We're heading east and north for our next story to the Indian Ocean and the whales that live there. Blue whales are the largest animals that have ever lived. Their tongues alone can weigh as much as an elephant. So it's a little hard to believe that a whole population of them have gone unnoticed by scientists until now. But they have, and researchers just identified them by their own unique song. Salvatore Sergio is a marine mammal biologist at the African Aquatic Conservation Fund, which has offices in Massachusetts and Senegal. Salvatore, how did you discover this new group of blue whales?
So I was acoustically monitoring for baleen whales off of Madagascar first. I was listening for whale songs in the ocean. We were quite surprised when we got recordings back and we noticed 3 or 4 different types of blue whale songs, including one that we did not recognize.
Wow. You heard a different sound. And we have some audio of that sound. It's been sped up around 20 times faster, so it's audible to human ears. Let's give it a listen. How is that song different than the songs of other blue whale populations?
So this song has only two notes, which you heard the ba ba, and that is one of the distinct parts of it. Other songs have three or four different notes and maybe a different pattern, a different arrangement.
So you hear this new sound, you know it's a blue whale. It sounds different from the other sounds of blue whales that you know of. What do you do next? How do you confirm that it is a blue whale and it's different?
Well, the first thing I did was talk to other researchers that were familiar with blue whales to get opinions on whether or not they also thought this was a blue whale. And there was wide agreement that this looked like a new blue whale song. I was also collaborating with researchers in the northern Indian Ocean off the coast of Oman, and we recorded this novel blue whale song there as well. And that's when the pieces of the puzzle started to come together. What we realized is that we had recorded the song of this population in the northwestern Indian Ocean off Oman for the first time. And that's an important point because of the history of the Arabian Sea in the North Indian Ocean and the whaling that had gone on, illegal whaling in the 1960s.
Ah, so this is kind of a replenishing of the population to some degree.
Well, we hope that the population is recovering from the whaling that occurred. The most important part of this finding is that there is a population in the Arabian Sea that we know very little about that needs more research because it's probably a population that was impacted by whaling and needs to be protected.
Hmm. I'm curious, do both male and female blue whales sing?
That is a very good question. We assume it's mostly or only males that sing. However, again, there's so little known about blue whales. The few animals that have been sexed that were known to sing were males, so that fits the theory.
You think it might be kind of a protracted mating dance, like I'm over here and I'm pretty cool, come on over?
Exactly. It's most likely a reproductive display. Song is used as a reproductive display throughout the animal kingdom, from birds to crickets to whales.
Hmm. There's so much bad news about blue whales. They're endangered and they face lots of threats, getting tangled in fishing gear, getting hit by boats, pollution, climate change, to name just a few. How does it feel to find some good news for once?
Well, it's very exciting. First of all, to make a discovery like this is a rare event. It's very important for us because we really want to protect these animals. And that's the key aspect here, that we're defining a group so that we can conserve it.
Salvatore Sergio is a marine mammal biologist at the African Aquatic Conservation Fund. He's a visiting scientist at the New England Aquarium. Thanks a lot, Salvatore.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to The World. A loose-lipped FSB agent and poisoned underwear. A Russian opposition leader investigates his own attempted assassination.
I still can't believe this is happening, but my first thought is, oh my God.
And peace holds in Nagorno-Karabakh, and winemakers there are salvaging the grapes that survived the conflict. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region began more than a month ago between the Tigray People's Liberation Front and Ethiopia's federal government. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says the region has now returned to normal. He's claimed that no civilians were killed during the weeks of military operations there. But more than 50,000 Ethiopian refugees have fled Tigray from neighboring Sudan, and they tell a different story. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gakandi, has been to Sudan to speak with some of them.
In the past month, the Umra Kuba refugee camp has grown into the size of a small city. It's now home to more than 20,000 refugees who fled the conflict in Tigray. Every day, more Ethiopians arrive on buses. It's sweltering hot here, more than 90 degrees outside. Dozens of bright white tents are lined up in rows. On them is the logo of the United Nations Refugee Agency. Music blares from stereo speakers attached to phones. Some refugees have already set up small kiosks to sell goods. Children play outside, and some of them have even begun attending classes run by NGOs. Fisaha Gebreselassie arrived here about a month ago. He's a mechanic from the Ethiopian town of Adabe, not far from the border with Sudan. Now he tries to make a living selling fried bread in the camp. He rolls the dough into balls, then flattens them between his hands before dropping them into a vat of sizzling oil.
Bomboloni.
It's called bomboloni, he says with a smile. A taste of home that's in high demand here. Despite having arrived with little, Gebre Selassie gives me and my colleagues some fresh bomboloni to eat. Then he puts down his cooking materials so he can tell us his story. When the fighting first started in November in Tigray, Gebre Selassie says he fled with his 11-year-old son, Sammy. They were with a group of people. He says they encountered both federal Ethiopian troops and Eritrean soldiers. The Ethiopian government has denied receiving any support from neighboring Eritrea, and with limited access to the region, it's been difficult to confirm these details. Gebre Selassie tells me the Eritrean troops were wearing civilian clothes, but he says he could identify some of them by their tribal markings. He pauses, tears well in his eyes, and he tells me how one of the soldiers shot his son twice. Gebre Selassie says he begged them to let him bring Sammy to a doctor, but to no avail. The boy bled to death, and Gebre Selassie says he buried Sammy just before fleeing into neighboring Sudan. I would never go back to Ethiopia, he tells me, unless Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is ousted or resigns. This is Gebre Selassie's second time as a refugee in Sudan, he tells me. He even speaks Arabic, a language he learned here. After he first arrived, he says he had to sleep outdoors for 20 nights straight. He only just received a tent here in the refugee camp. Food, water, and medicine are still limited here, he says. Aid organizations have been rushing to scale up services, but even when those basic needs are provided for, the trauma will remain, says Teum Haile Selassie. He's a doctor. I met him at the Hamdayat Refugee Transit Center, close to the border. Haile Selassie had just moved to Tigray from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, when the fighting started. He says he had invested all of his money to set up a private clinic there. Now he's a refugee, like everyone else. Refugees are facing hunger, thirst, injuries, Haile Selassie tells me. But the biggest problem is psychological pain. He says refugees might return home one day and replace the things they lost, but the trauma from what he called a genocide will remain, and the world will be to blame, he says. Haile Selassie has been practicing medicine for nearly 30 years. Still, he says he's not immune to the emotional trauma. Haile Selassie says some days he feels confused, in shock at what he saw in Tigray, where possibly thousands of people have been killed. He removes his glasses, given to him by a Sudanese local, and wipes the tears from his eyes. Luckily, his family is safe, he says, because they live in a different part of Ethiopia. But Haile Selassie worries about the ethnic tensions he's seeing in the country. As a doctor, he says he never served people based on their identity, but now he was being singled out as a Tigrayan. Both government forces and local militias from different ethnic groups have been accused of ethnic violence or profiling during the conflict in Tigray. Haile Selassie says it will take 20 years for Ethiopia to recover from this. A large truck arrives bringing clean water for refugees. Jason Rizzo is the project coordinator with Doctors Without Borders at a medical clinic here. About a dozen people are waiting there when I arrive. Some are new arrivals from Ethiopia, says Rizzo.
I mean, the very first thing that we can do, and it's a pretty simple thing, is psychological first aid. It's just being present and being there to talk to people, having someone that refugees can come to and talk to.
Many refugees I speak with here tell me they want people around the world to know what's happening in Tigray. Communications were blocked out there for weeks. They've returned to some areas, but not others. So here, in the refugee camps, people see a chance to get their story out. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Eastern Sudan.
Halima's reporting on the Tigray conflict continues on The World. Head over to our website for more reporting on how the conflict erupted and what the repercussions are for the Horn of Africa. And we'll have more stories from Tigray in the coming days. That's all at theworld.org. Alexei Navalny is Russia's most prominent opposition politician and President Vladimir Putin's harshest critic. Navalny is also lucky to be alive. This past summer, he was mysteriously poisoned. Over the last few weeks, investigative journalists, with help from Navalny himself, have managed to piece together the story of exactly what happened. The World's Daniel Offman reports.
Alexei Navalny is a household name in Russia. That's because there just aren't many prominent opposition figures willing to speak up the way he does. Navalny accused Vladimir Putin of being corrupt, a thief, and a liar. Over the years, Navalny has been barred from running for public office, banned from appearing on state media. This cat-and-mouse game has gone on for almost a decade. This past summer, though, it became a matter of life and death. Navalny was on a domestic flight from Siberia to Moscow, and he fell ill. That's Navalny agonizing in pain, as heard on a video shot by another passenger. Minutes later, Navalny lost consciousness. The pilot made an emergency landing in the Siberian city of Omsk. Medics saved his life, but he was still in rough shape.
A medically equipped plane has been flown to Omsk by a German charity who want to evacuate him. But his wife, Yulia, claimed the authorities were refusing to let him go.
By the time Yulia Navalny landed in Omsk, Alexei was in a coma. It took a couple of days and a direct letter to President Putin himself, but Yulia got permission to take her husband to a hospital in Berlin. He was flown to Germany on August 22nd.
German authorities say they found evidence Alexei Navalny, a vocal critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin, was poisoned by the nerve agent Novichok.
Novichok is a military-grade nerve agent developed by the Soviet Union, and the toxin has been used before in other assassination attempts on Russian citizens. On September 7th, Alexei came out of his medically induced coma and started down the road to recovery. In an interview with 60 Minutes, he spoke about the Novichok finding.
I think for Putin, why he's using this chemical weapon to do both, kill me and, you know, terrify others.
But where's the evidence? How could anyone be sure that the Kremlin was behind the poisoning? That's where Christo Groziev comes in. He's the lead investigative journalist with Bellingcat. In 2018, he identified the two Russian military intelligence agents behind the assassination of Sergei Skripal, a former Russian spy. But cracking the Navalny case, this seemed like a much tougher challenge.
Initially, we waited a few weeks and didn't even look at this case because we thought, what are the chances we can get sufficient data from within Russia?
Groziev teamed up with a group of five media organizations, and they started their investigation by looking at the poison itself. Based on an earlier report, Groziev says that they knew Russia was still producing the nerve agent, Novichok.
We had been able to identify the lab where Russia currently upgrades its original Novichok. We had the phone records of the key researchers, and we were able to look at whom they called at around the time of the poisoning of Navalny.
He says they identified call patterns, the times and the frequency of the calls, and then linked those phone numbers with Russian intelligence personnel from the FSB. That's the main successor of the KGB.
And here comes the actual breaking point in our investigation, where I got the names and I put them in a leaked database of airplane records. And we found out that in 2017, these FSB officers in groups of two or three had tailed Alexei Navalny on more than 37 flights.
Those FSB officers started tracking him then and continued to do so right into 2020.
These officers never flew on the same flight that Navalny did, but usually on the previous flight before his flight and on the next one after that, in order to avoid being identified after so many joint destinations with him.
Grozev and his team concluded, based on their evidence, that the plan was to poison Navalny, and they identified the FSB agents tasked with the operation.
No alternative explanation could justify and explain the close tailing by chemical weapons experts and by doctors of Navalny, plus the peaks in communication just before and after these trips that tailed Navalny.
The Bellingcat investigation was published 2 weeks ago. A couple of days after that, President Putin was scheduled to host one of his marathon press conferences. And of course, he was asked about it.
Это не какое-то расследование. Это легализация материалов американских спецслужб.
Putin claimed that Navalny, or the Berlin patient, as he called him, is, quote, enjoying the support of U.S. special services, and that since Western intelligence agencies are working with Navalny, then, of course, Russian special services were tracking him.
Но это совсем не значит, что его травить нужно. Кому он нужен? Если бы хотели, наверное, довели бы до конца.
But that doesn't mean they poisoned him, Putin said. Investigative journalist Christo Grozev tells me that he listened closely to what Putin had to say.
Then he said, if we had wanted to poison him, we would have done the job to the end. We would have finished off that job.
Putin never directly challenged the conclusions of the report, and he didn't say that the FSB would never poison a Russian citizen. But still, from Grozev's perspective, one piece of the story was still missing. It was an unlikely piece of evidence that Navalny and Bellingcat published a week later.
Привет, это Навальный. Я же говорил, что вся эта история с отравлением...
Навальный posted a video on YouTube last Monday where he explained part two of the investigation. Navalny and his team decided to call all eight members of the FSB team that tried to poison him. Most of them quickly hung up or ignored the call, except for one.
Константин.
Konstantin Kudryavtsev. On the call, Navalny pretended to be an official with the Russian National Security Council. He told Kudryavtsev that he was working on a report detailing why the operation to poison Navalny failed. Here's Christo Grozev again.
I could hardly believe my ears. I mean, I thought this is never going to work. First of all, because FSB officers are not going to talk in an open line. And second, because they're going to recognize your voice. So that's not going to work. He said, let me try it.
And it worked. Konstantin Kudryavtsev, the FSB agent, actually spoke with Navalny for about 45 minutes. During that conversation, Kudryavtsev confirmed many details from the Bellingcat investigation. Kudryavtsev explained that he was the cleanup man, tasked with getting rid of all the traces of Novichok that could implicate Russian agents. At one point in the phone call, Navalny asked this question.
Which of the items that you treated for decontamination might still contain some risky concentration of poison? And to this, there was a clear and immediate answer. It's the groin area, the crotch area of the underpants, to which Navalny followed up by a trick question. He said, the gray pants? He knew that he didn't have gray pants there. And the answer was, no, the blue pants. And that was exactly the pair of pants that he was wearing when he collapsed into a coma.
When Navalny asked why the operation failed, Kudryavtsev said, if the pilot hadn't made an emergency landing, and if the medics had not tended to Navalny,
then things might have turned out in our favor, as he said. And in our favor clearly meant in death.
Grozev tells me he was in the room with Navalny during the phone call, and he could hardly believe what he was hearing.
I still can't believe this is happening, but my first thought is, oh my God, everything that I hypothesized for 2 months and worked on is coming to life. And it's much scarier than I thought, because I hear it from a person who was involved in it.
I need to ask this. Is there any doubt in your mind that this was directed from on top, from Putin?
No. I mean, it would probably be equally plausible that it was directed by a Martian.
And that's what Alexei Navalny says, too. Even so, the opposition politician says he plans to return to Russia as soon as possible. People are watching, Navalny says. And it's his job to not be afraid. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Sometimes it seems that all of our dreams have been dashed. Words from the Prime Minister of Armenia, Nikol Pashinyan, as the country mourned its dead. Around 3,000 Armenian troops died in 6 weeks of fighting with Azerbaijan in the region called Nagorno-Karabakh. In the end, Azerbaijan gained control of most of that territory. Many Armenians are now calling for their prime minister to step down. One of Armenia's oldest industries, wine, has also suffered in the conflict. Andrew Connolly reports.
At the Stepanakert brandy factory, conveyor belts rattle, scientists in white coats peer into flasks, and women pack bottles into cases. It's the first day of business in Karabakh's capital since war erupted on September 27th. And operations director Vladik Alibabian is seeing what can be salvaged.
We managed to collect 1,700 tons of grapes before the war and then everything shut down. Some of our fields near the front lines where we grew grapes and pomegranates are now under control of Azerbaijani forces. The loss for the industry will be significant.
A shaft of sunlight beams through a small hole in the roof of a warehouse next door. Underneath, protruding from the bottom of a cylindrical tank, is a gigantic unexploded rocket, one of the thousands that rained down on the city during Armenia's 44-day war with Azerbaijan. The rocket hit an empty tank, narrowly missing a vat full of 15-year-old Madatov cognac, a lucky escape for the factory, but for the country's nascent wine industry as a whole, the war has been a huge setback. The latest conflict flared up in the middle of the harvest season. As the country mobilized for war, grapes wilted on the vine. But some people were able to adapt. Artisan winemaker David Asatrian is making brandy from grape residue on a rattling homemade stove at his little farm on the other side of town.
So how do I say the correct word for cheers?
On the first day that shells landed on Stepanakert, David's son headed for the front line. David joined him days later, with a few hundred bottles to boost the troops' morale. David produces tangy orange-colored wines, stored in clay amphoras and buried underground. He also makes full-bodied inky reds using Khindogni, a grape indigenous to Nagorno-Karabakh. Khindogni is our local grape. There's no sense using any others, he says. It gives great dry wine on its own, and we use it to add quality to blends. This is a trademark of Karabakh. It's been growing here for centuries with this soil, air, and sunshine. If you grow the same grape anywhere else, David explains, it tastes totally different. Khindogni is derived from the word laughter in Armenian, though there hasn't been much to laugh about this year. Asatrian's land, bathed in early December sunshine, looks out across the valley and up to the mountaintop city of Shushi. As the highest and most strategic settlement in Karabakh, the war was effectively finished when Azerbaijan captured the city. That ended more than three decades of Armenian control. And now, though people displaced during the war are coming back home, many feel vulnerable to attack from the new Azerbaijani positions above them. I see the people coming back, Satrin says cautiously, looking up to the hills. But I don't see life returning to normal. We'll have to wait and see. Vahe Kushgerian is one of the top winemakers and entrepreneurs in Armenia. For him, attracting investment into the vineyards of an unrecognized country and occasional war zone has never been easy. Under most international law, Nagorno-Karabakh is considered to be part of Azerbaijan.
No institution at EBRD, World Bank, Asian Development Bank, they never touched Karabakh.
That's because of the legal status.
By their charter, they couldn't. So they would bug me to invest in Armenia, in vineyards, winery, but Karabakh was completely off limits.
International recognition of the territory looks like a distant dream. But despite the ruins of war, Kushgerian is determined to make the best of a bad situation.
There used to be a winery there that was abandoned. And I am tinkering whether to take that as a symbolic and start a cooperative winery. There's something about continuing, regardless of whatever calamity happened, we need to go on forward, you know.
So if you look at the color of the wine, mm-hmm. as we do a proper...
Armenia has one of the world's oldest wine industries. Archaeologists have unearthed fragments of jugs and presses dating back more than 6,000 years. But the country's turbulent history has kept it from becoming a Napa Valley of the Caucasus. For 70 years, the Soviet economy demanded that Armenia prioritize brandy production instead of wine. Poverty in the 80s and conflict with Azerbaijan in the 90s didn't help either. But in the last decade, the country experienced a wine-drinking renaissance, says Mariam Sagtelian, a partner at In Vino, one of Yerevan's first wine bars.
So we're almost eight, turning eight this year, December 30th. We opened in 2012. And at that time, we only had 10 drinkable Armenian wines. Now we have over 180 or something.
But just as the business was in full bloom, war came to Armenia once again, and some of the country's most notable vineyards are now behind enemy lines. Within days, bottles from the lost territories flew off the shelves to be resold by speculators. And Sagatelian explains, decades-old family businesses evaporated overnight.
You can't just leave it. Wine is like it's your baby. First of all, you plant the vines. It takes up to 4 years for them to actually give you some type of grapes to use. And then after all that, you work on the quality of the wine by doing pruning. And so you spend like the whole year you're working just for this one season where you can collect the grapes and make wine. So when the season comes and this war happens, it's very heartbreaking.
Sagatelian hopes that the conflict will encourage outsiders, including Armenia's huge global diaspora, to support the struggling region even more.
These are programs which take years and years to work on. For me, it's the worst thing is thinking about it like, okay, making wine here. What if this happens? What if another war breaks out right now? What if? So these are all the questions. But if you keep on thinking, what if, you never really do anything. So do it. You know, life is short. It really is.
War and the COVID-19 pandemic have wrecked the Armenian economy. The same attachment to the land of Nagorno-Karabakh that's produced such fine wines has also cost thousands of lives. But against all the odds, Armenia's winemakers are defiant and hope that by stimulating local businesses, the region one day might have something to celebrate. For the world, I'm Andrew Connolly, Yerevan.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow. From PRX.